Chevy Equinox with forward collision alert, automatic emergency braking, and available all-wheel drive. It's my ultimate mobile device. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com to schedule a test drive. Chevy Equinox. It's your choice. Own it.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Every day.
Here's John Williams.
John, how are you? In the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. We're here until 3 o'clock, then Ro and Anna come in. Until then,
Lord have mercy.
See what we can put together. I've got some thoughts, feelings, and recollections about Hugh Hefner and Playboy magazine when we recorded the Mincing Rascals podcast. I mentioned this to Steve Bertrand a little while ago. We all sort of recollected, what's your Playboy magazine story, boys? I don't know if women have a reaction to that, too, but men of a certain age, and I would say it's 100 down to something, 30, 20, 50, wherever the mark is, have a story of growing up around with or through that magazine, where you got caught or where you found some or where you have a Playboy magazine story. I'm going to ask you for that on Facebook and on our text line, and we'll give you a chance to call in on that as well. The Playboy magazine theme... Actually, no, the Playboy After Dark theme goes like this. Rick Hogan's in our studio. He wrote the story about Hugh Hefner's passing. You familiar with this song?
Oh, yeah.
I am not.
It's a lovely, listen to it.
It is nice.
It's a lovely theme song.
Back and watched a lot of the clips from the old Playboy After Dark show just as I was thinking about Hugh Hefner today. And it was really interesting because it was not great television and it wasn't as sexy as I thought it was going to be or as I remembered it.
Yeah.
But there was some pretty good music on that show.
And there were some pretty good guests there. I mean, at one point, one that I remember distinctly is it's the first time I ever saw Nina Simone perform. And I'm thinking... What is Nina Simone? This is when, in an age when African Americans were hardly ever on television at all.
The clip I watched was Sammy Davis Jr.
Yeah.
singing in the
yeah.
lounge there, and it was, or in the man, it wasn't the mansion, it was a TV set.
It was a TV set, yeah.
Made to look like some sort of swinging Playboy mansion, and it was good. It was really good.
Well, he knew how to spread that brand, man.
But you know,
he knew how to spread the brand.
Okay, so we'll just dive right into this. There was something also that, to me, was sort of incongruent about it. I mean, when you think of somebody who is promoting or selling sex, you might think of somebody who's more braggadocious or more coarse. But he was a little James Bond, suave and debonair, wasn't he?
Well, because I think sex was a part of it in the same way that sex was always, you may not realize it, not you, but people may not realize it as much. Sex was always part of the Bond movies, too. The names of the girls, the bathing suits, the dripping wet Ursula Andress. If that wasn't sex, I don't know what was. He was selling, I think, a lifestyle that included sex and beautiful women. I think that's the reason you felt that way about the show, John. It was everything. It was the coolest stereo. It was the coolest friends. It was the best wine. It was the finest clothes and the cutest girls.
So in the Tribune online right now, you wrote, you can read it. Was this in print today?
Yes,
or is this
it's in print tomorrow? Later print? Edition. No, it's in print today.
Yeah, and online as well. Some years ago, sitting in his castle-like mansion in Hombly Hills neighborhood of Los Angeles, Hugh Hefner was telling a visitor about the Halloween party taking place there in a few days. It would be, what, the 7,435th party of Hefner's exceptional, charmed, and successful life, a lavish bash for 1,000 or so of his closest and most comely friends. Now, this is a costume party, said Hefner. You will have to wear a costume. I was thinking, said the visitor, that with all due respect, I might get some pajamas, a robe, a pipe, slippers, and Pepsi, and going as, well, the young Hugh Hefner. The then 73-year-old Hefner laughed. He gave a sly smile and said, I'm sorry, that won't work. I'm going as the young Hugh Hefner.
That was me sitting with him. That was me. in his house doing that.
Really?
And it was embarrassing. I mean, I thought, oh, what a cool idea. I'll go as a young Hugh Hefner.
You just called him an old man.
Yeah. The way he looked at me was like, I was an idiot. I was an idiot. That was some party, man. The only people there, there were a number of topless young women who were dressed in some odd. I said, well, what is your costume exactly? Well, I'm a topless angel. Okay. There were like five of those. The only people not in costume at that party that I easily recognizable were Alan Thicke, Lou Ferrigno, and of all people, Cato Kaelin.
Why not?
Why not exactly? Everybody was saying, Jack Nicholson's here, Jack Nicholson's here. And people are like, where is he? Where is he? Where is he? And people are going, well, he's probably in costume. But it was one of the most lavish parties I have ever been to in my life.
So in your piece, you remind us his family's from Nebraska, but he was born in Chicago.
He was born in Chicago. He was born at Michael Reese Hospital.
Yeah.
Maybe the new setting for the, you know, for Amazon when it comes here. Raised on the Northwest Side in a pretty strict, very strict, actually, Methodist family. Went to public grammar school.
A Ravenswood kid?
No, more like Galewood, West.
And so he's in high school putting out his own little publication,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. He had somehow, and you can't figure out how, some kind of artistic sensibility. He was always drawing comics. In grammar school, he published a paper of some sort, and that made a teacher go to his parents and say, look, if he continues this kind of behavior, he's going to wind up as a nothing. But he always did have that urge. He continued doing it in the 2.5 years. And you got to remember, he graduated University of Illinois, Champaign, in 2.5 years.
Yeah, why?
Because he was smart, and he was driven. Yeah. He was driven. I don't know if he knew what he was driven to.
Well, that's interesting, because I think the same person that says, I have this burning fire and I've got to do something with it, I'm going to not just go to U of I and have fun. I'm going to get through there in 2.5 years and leave a year and a half of fun on the table. To what end? But then he's got a job as an editor at a magazine.
Well, first, then he went in the service for a year.
Yeah, a lot of folks forget that.
And then he was like a copywriter for Esquire magazine. And in one of the biggest mistakes in the history of American publishing, Esquire is going to move from Chicago to New York. They're going to move their offices. And Hefner, I think, was making something like $60 a week. And he said, okay, I'll go if you give me a $5 raise. And they said no. They said no to
Why
Hugh
was
Hefner.
That a big mistake? Because he then goes
It was
off.
A big mistake for Esquire. It was a big mistake for Esquire. You got the young Hugh Hefner out there going, yeah, I have a new idea. What do you guys think of this? But I will maintain, John, that Hugh Hefner was indeed, for what he did, the right guy at the right time in the very sort of puritanical 50s, but also the right place. I do not believe that he would have been able to make a success of Playboy magazine had he been trying to do it in Manhattan, or certainly had he trying to been do it in, you know, Mobile, Alabama, or Omaha, Nebraska. I think the environment was right for him.
Why? How so?
Well, because I think there was a certain element of sophistication in Chicago just by dint of it being a big city. I also think that it inspired him when he got out of college in the service and he was married to Millie, who is still alive, by the way, his first wife. Mm. And they had little Christie in 1952, that he was able to wander the city and look at things that he aspired to. I mean, in Omaha, you would have walked around, I suppose, and looked at cattle farms and said, well, I don't want to be a cattle farmer. But he saw there was a level of sophistication that I think helped inspire what Playboy became.
Tell the story of his renting Marilyn Monroe's nude photo and how that launched his first edition.
Yeah, he wanted to feature naked women, which is highly unusual. And you're courting all sorts of problems with the law. But he would go to various art places that sold and rented photos, and he wound up being able to rent, not to own, a nude photo of Marilyn Monroe for $200.
Which is a lot of money, I presume, at the time.
I don't think it was that much money,
really,
even at the time.
Yeah.
Because Marilyn Monroe was a pretty considerable star.
Now that you mention it,
but this guy, whoever this guy was, owned the rights to the photo and said, sure, $200. He could not get... Something missing from my story, because the story is so long. He couldn't get a Chicago printer to print the magazine. He had to go get it printed in the suburbs.
Because they didn't want to touch the pornography?
Correct. What they thought was pornography. These were, I mean, I was born in 1953, but I was a little baby, so I don't know how pinched this place was. There were magazines you could buy, but nothing the mainstream.
So how does that first issue sell? You point out that he didn't put a date on it because, you know, this wasn't volume one. He wasn't sure there was going to be volume
two.
No
question. It sold roughly 70,000 copies in 2 weeks.
A light bulb.
And he was on, his way. He initially wanted to call, not to get too deep in the, which is here, when he started, he was the only employee. He wanted to call the magazine Stag Party, you know, with a logo being a stag, a deer. And there were some copyright problems, and he couldn't do that. So he went to visit a man who was still alive, a designer, art director named Art Paul, who had a small office in the Loop. And he went down and told Art Paul what he was doing, and Art Paul was sort of intrigued. He, too, was a young, creative guy. And they said, well, we can't call it Stag. What do you, let's come up with another kind of animal. And so these two guys, you would love to hear this conversation. They were like, you know, don't, I guess it would be like this, don't bunnies like to have sex and stuff, Hef? And they go, well, yeah, I guess. And, well, what about a bunny? And in less than 1 hour, Art Paul sat down with a pen and a piece of paper and came up with one of the most identifiable logos in the history of American business. It is up there with the McDonald's arches, the Nike swoosh. And it didn't take, you know, as I suppose now, if you and I said, so I don't know about the Apple logo. It seems relatively simple. I'm sure it cost somebody millions of dollars to create it and a million focus groups. And are we going to do this? They were by the seat of their pants. And by that second issue, the Playboy Bunny logo appeared, and it's appeared in every magazine since. And on clubs and on planes. And
the thing took off. And through the 60s and early 70s, it was this empire.
Yeah.
Airplanes and movies and clubs and casinos.
Yep.
Then what happened?
Well, the casino business went sort of bust in London under a guy named Vic Lounge, who had been one of the early guys here. At Playboy's height, it was selling 8 million copies of that magazine every month. That's a lot. The clubs kept doing well, but then, you know, the world got more sophisticated. Penthouse magazine came out, and that cut a little into the whole circulation. Mores got a little looser, and certainly, you know, Hefner went to court dozens of times to fight for the First Amendment, the freedom of speech.
Well, you know, that's funny because I don't know why I'm such a fuddy-duddy about this subject, but I always have been. I mean, to me, there's two versions of Hugh Hefner. One is the First Amendment champion and this progressive social thinker.
Civil rights champion.
And then the other one is just kind of this creepy guy in silk pajamas who in his 70s has a 27-year-old girlfriend. And I think...
See, I think that...
I don't know how to reconcile those two.
Well, because his later year, had Hef died at, like, let's say 73, right after I interviewed him. He was so shocked by the nature of the interview that he just had a heart attack. Then he would be thought of a lot vastly different. I do think that in his later years, probably 70 on, he did seem like some kind of weird caricature, some kind of weird uncle. You know, the satin robe, the pajamas, the unbelievably young blonde, buxom women that he
triplets, for God's sake.
I know. But I also think, in his defense, and I can't tell you this for sure, but I'd bet a lot, that he was in his way trying to still be the brand when he would, and this was in the 90s, when people like Leonardo DiCaprio and the young, hot crowd of actors were all admiring and idolizing him. I think it gave him, and I think he thought that that kind of idolization would help the magazine and help the empire.
Yeah.
So I can't blame him for being kind of, you know, it's like Willie Mays in the outfield, man. It's like, you know, do you really need to play Willie when you can't get that fireball and fall down? Yeah, he needs to play.
It's 1:23. Our phone lines are ringing with people who have their Playboy magazine story. Do you have one? I'm going to pause here.
Well, it's not really a story. It's just a list of where I would steal the magazine.
Well, that's
a young teenager.
Steve Cochran had a story like that, too, I think, or at least he would read it in the drugstore tucked into a Life magazine. I have a story, too. We all do. But just tell me that little anecdote. It doesn't need to be life-shattering or changing, but 312-981-7200. You can text it to that number, too. Ellis handed me a sheet of some of your texts. A few years ago, when Hefner's Little Black Book came out to talk about what Hugh Hefner meant to a lot of people.
What's your favorite Chicago memories? Give me two or three.
The last 2 years of high school were like a mini hint of what life might be like after Playboy. I think that I, quite literally, on a personal level, I started Playboy because of dreams put away, the dreams that came from childhood and adolescence.
So it's kind of
the last 2 years of high school. A while back, a writer for National Geographic was doing a piece on Sunset Strip, and it interviewed me. And in the interview, he said that he had seen his first nude in Playboy magazine. I said, "That's okay. I saw my very first nude in your magazine." When we were kids back then, National Geographic.
I guess you're right now that we think about it.
Yeah, because you go to the library and you flip through.
Funny back then. One of the problems with marriage in modern society is that we live too long. You know, in the old days, it was much easier, you know, to make a lifetime commitment if your lifetime was only about 40 years.
Bill Zemme, Steve Cochran, and Hugh Hefner here on WGN Radio, the full interview at WGNRadio.com. I think men of a certain age have a Playboy magazine story.
No question. No question. I've heard about 80 of them today.
Got me more than you may want to hear.
Yeah.
I'm going to make you listen to a couple
of
others.
Just read them. I've read them. I haven't been answering the phone today, John.
Hey, Alan, you're on WGN Radio. Hi.
Hi, how you guys doing?
What's good on your mind, man?
So I was maybe 11 or 12 years old. My neighbor left a stack of Playboys out by the garbage.
That fool.
Yeah, that fool. I thought it was pretty cool, though, so I was okay with it. I took them, put them in the back bedroom in the closet, hid them back there. Of course, my mother eventually found them, which didn't make me happy, but she also immediately blamed me. And I have an older brother. I have a father. I'm like, hey, it wasn't me.
I'm only 11, Mom. I'm only 11.
God, that was
right away, funny.
Somehow, it was me.
I was probably 10 when we found our first stash, and, you know, we were beyond belief excited. We had no idea what to do with these things.
Yeah.
We knew what we were looking at, but we didn't know what to do.
So you dipped right into you said, okay, let's find that Norman Mailer short story in here. Yeah.
We weren't fully formed sexual creatures.
Right,
so
correct.
We knew that there was something going on here, but we really weren't sure what to do with it all. And we found him in the woods, and we were like, oh, my God, look at this. But we knew we couldn't bring it home, and we couldn't stay in the woods. So we tore some pictures out and stuck them to the trees and ran home and told our mom and dad. And
what a good boy you were.
What a ridiculous thing to do.
What a good boy.
It was a very confusing age. Alan, thanks for the call.
Sure, you bet. Nice talking to you guys.
Yeah,
thanks,
likewise. Don, you're on WGN. Hi.
Hi, I was early 60s, probably 13 or 14 years old, got my first babysitting job with three local boys, and of course I was a farm kid and pretty well sheltered, and while I'm babysitting these boys, one of them, the youngest one, probably 6 or 7 years old, says, "You want to see some boobies?" I went, huh?
Yeah.
And he ran to his parents' bedroom, came back with the very first Playboy. In fact, I didn't even know it existed. And so he whips it open, and I look at it, and I kind of nonchalant. I said, hey, by the way, it's you guys, it's time to go to bed.
Yeah. I'm a good babysitter now. Don, thanks for the call. All our phone lines are filled with stories like that. Okay.
Everybody's got them. I mean, men of a certain age, certainly.
Let's just do one more here real quick. Hey, Mike, you're on WGN Radio. Jump in there, Mike. What did you want to say? Hey, Mike. Hey, Mike, is that you?
Hello.
Hey,
hello.
You're on the air.
I'm here. Okay.
He's still listening to his radio. We'll come back to Mike another time. Read Rick Hogan online, chicagotribune.com, and listen to him. When do we listen to you again here?
Sunday night. 9 to 11. Thank you, John. And go see John and his Minsky and Rascals and other GN folks at the podcast festival
October
coming up
this, 7th.
This week. Yeah, this week. Good luck there. It's fun.
Yeah, I know
it's
you've fun. Done this sort of thing before, and I appreciate that because I'm a little nervous about who the heck wants to come and watch me and Eric Zorn.
More people than you would imagine, John.
WGNRadio.com/events. Kristen McQuarrie and Steve Bertrand, too. Thank you, sir.